This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on the show, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape calls on Australia's Parliament to have faith in his country. Fiji's former Prime Minister is before the court on abuse of office charges. And Papua New Guinea's main morgue runs out of space as bodies pile up. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape became the first Pacific leader to address Australia's Parliament. Speaking to both houses this week, Mr. Marape paid tribute to Australia's decision to grant his country independence almost 50 years ago.
A leader from the highlands of Papua New Guinea, where I come from, once visited Canberra and Australia in the 1950s. His name is Kondom Agwendo. He made a speech in his own mother tongue because he knew no English. And he made a statement that is quite sentimental and historic. He said, "Today I come to you and speak to you in my language and you laugh at me. One day my son will come to you and speak in your language and you will certainly listen. Today as I stand before you in your wonderful house, this prophecy is being fulfilled. I speak to you in the language you taught me. I want to say thank you to all before him, but more importantly, to the memory of Prime Minister Whitlam, for being perhaps the most socially progressive of his time, for his policy of self-determination for Indigenous people of Australia, and for heeding the cries of the founding fathers of Papua New Guinea for our own self-determination. Mr. Whitlam, we honour your memory, sir. Your name is now etched into the history books of Papua New Guinea forever, taught in schools, uttered every year when we raise our flag and celebrated our independence on 16th September.
As the ABC's PNG correspondent Tim Swanston explains, the pomp of his Canberra visit is in stark contrast to the political situation back home.
Arriving outside Parliament, PNG Prime Minister James Marape was welcomed with a traditional artillery salute. He was greeted by Anthony Albanese and other dignitaries. The anthems were played, and then inside, the formalities continued.
Mr. Prime Minister, I welcome you to the House of Representatives Chamber.
The invite was extended to PNG's Prime Minister after Prime Minister Albanese's own address to PNG's Parliament last year. Welcoming Mr. Marape to the chamber, Mr. Albanese spoke about a new era of cooperation between the two countries.
It will be a decisive decade for us, and it can be a decisive decade because of us, because of what we decide together.
The key theme of Mr. Marape's speech was to thank Australia for the mutual transition into independence in 1975.
It was from this Parliament that many decisions were made that have helped and shaped what Papua New Guinea was before 1975 and what Papua New Guinea is after 1975. This is why Papua New Guinea has a very special and very unique relationship with Australia.
This visit comes less than a month after deadly riots rocked PNG's capital of Port Moresby and several provincial centres. A commission of inquiry is being set up to look into the involvement of PNG police in the riots and how to improve the country's security forces. Opposition MPs have repeatedly blamed the violence on the poor standards of living for many in PNG. Mr. Marape acknowledged the need for greater empowerment of his citizens and issued a strong plea to Australia to stick by their side.
As I visit you today, I ask you, do not give up on Papua New Guinea. We have always bounced back from our low moments, and we will continue to grow, learning from every low moments and every high moments.
PNG relies on considerable financial support from Australia, some $1.2 billion since 2019, and Mr. Marape spoke about the need to expand his country's economic base.
We must become a strong country, standing on our 2 feet, economically independent and strong, so we too can help Australia maintain democracy, preserve peace, and ensure stability in our part of planet Earth, in our Pacific.
Following the speech, Mr. Albanese and Mr. Marape held joint talks, of which security was a key feature. The two nations are still working out the finer details of $200 million in Australian spending that accompanied a bilateral security agreement signed in December. The pair also discussed expanding the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme and moves to make visa processes smoother for Papua New Guineans visiting Australia. Mr. Marape returns to PNG tomorrow and the country's parliament resumes next week. It'll be a fraught time, with a no-confidence motion grace period expiring, and the PM could face a test of his leadership as early as Tuesday.
That was the ABC's PNG correspondent, Tim Swanston. In Tonga, dialogue appears to be the way forward, following a political standoff between King Tupou VI and the Prime Minister, Siosi Sofaleni. The king has written to government, withdrawing his royal consent for the appointments of the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister for Defence, a portfolio currently held by the Prime Minister. But the government insists such action by the king is unconstitutional, and they've got the backing of the opposition, including MP Piveni Piukala.
To me, there is no constitutional clause that gave them authority to do this. This can be from the Privy Councils alone. There is no way here that they can ascertain that this is a royal command from the king. If they had put it that way, or if the king had wrote this letter to his nobles, then there is a way. If it's perceived to be from the Privy Council, because in our constitution, there is no power vested in the Privy Council for revoking and appointing a ministerial portfolio. There's no weight in this.
Yeah.
But it will open up discussions of why and as to why all these things is happening.
Is it possible it was done this way because the king does not have the power to strip portfolios? It has to be done on the advice of the Prime Minister. So could it have been done this way to avoid overstepping that constitutional limit, in that in this letter he's expressed his withdrawal of confidence and consent? It's like he's saying, I would like you to strip these portfolios. Do you think that's one way of looking at this?
Yes. But there could have been a better way. If that is the case, this is more of expressing his personal sentiment. It's no way a command to be taken. So in that sense, he probably, to me, the proper or better general is through his nobles. Because at the end, the only authority that he can work with, cabinet, parliament, and judiciary. There is no place of Privy Council in the authority of this country or executive authority of this country. There's no place for Privy Council. So if this is a way for him to express, then it makes sense. But there is no way that this is a royal command for him to overstep his constitutional right. For me personally, because he have 9 nobles in the house, in the parliament, that's basically under his authority. If he needed anything, that has to be activated from parliament. For him to be better advice is to write to his noble that I have withdrawn my confidence from the minister, from the Prime Minister and his minister. Now it's left to the Prime Minister, the Parliament, to address this issue. For me, this is an opportune time for all the politicians and the educated community to relook at the constitution that it was drafted and accepted in Parliament from 2010.
On to the government's response to this memorandum from the Privy Council. A statement's been put out saying that Cabinet sought the advice from the Attorney General. It was advised that the decision was contrary to the Constitution. What do you think about the government's response?
I think they're taking it the wrong way. I don't think that this is the time for them to fight over authority. I don't think that is the time. I think that they should seek to make peace with the king. It's not because they have to. I mean, it's not because they have to obey him. But what the use of a king if his wishes or command is not respected by his subject? It's basically they are silencing the existence of the king. I don't see that that's the direction or the way to handle this case. Of course, there is constitutional demarcation of authority, but under the rule of the king, under the constitutions, that respect they need. I think the cabinet should address this the other way around. That they should not. I don't see any good that will come out from fighting the king head on.
Tongan opposition MP Piveni Pukala speaking there to the ABC's Liam Fox. As one newspaper headline puts it, has the sea sponge just blown up the Paris Agreement on climate change? One of the key elements to emerge from the UN climate talks in 2015 was a push towards ambitious actions designed to keep global warming well below 1.5 degrees Celsius. But as Dubravka Volodya reports, Australian-led research into the humble sponge has found evidence that the 1.5 target has already been breached.
Scientists travel to the Caribbean to dive deep into the sea to find a certain type of sea sponge. For hundreds of years, they've acted as a form of natural thermometer. Emeritus Professor Malcolm McCulloch from the University of Western Australia says a surprising find was made when they looked at the animal skeleton.
We have an alternate record of global warming.
Previous estimates of warming and those used by the International Panel for Climate Change, or IPCC, are based on sea surface temperature and date back to the mid-1800s. Professor McCulloch said some sea sponges lived in lower parts of the ocean and contain hundreds of years of data on chemical changes within their skeletons. These can be used to estimate temperatures from much earlier times, spanning back 300 years. He says their estimates show the world already passed the 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming.
It's a different record. It's a record of the ocean mixed layer. It looks like the temperatures were underestimated by about half a degree. When you start from there, we passed 1.5 around 210 to 212. And up till about 2022, when we had the data in, it was about 1.7.
He says we are on track to exceed 2 degrees Celsius of warming by the late 2020s. Reaction to the study is mixed. The director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Dr. Gavin Schmidt, says people should be careful in assuming that data from one part of the Atlantic are reflective of other areas. Professor Mark Howden, director of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions, says it's an interesting study.
Importantly, it shows that the human influence on global temperatures was happening well back into the 1800s, earlier than some records would indicate, but also supporting some other studies which actually indicate very early influence of humans on global temperature.
Professor Howden, who's also the vice chair of the IPCC, believes it won't change any global targets.
The Paris Agreement essentially establishes a baseline, which is the pre-industrial baseline, and assesses some temperature increase above that baseline. So if we change the baseline to reflect this study, which, you know, indicates warming happened earlier, that baseline would have to be adjusted. But at the same time, to be consistent with the Paris Agreement, we'd need to change the temperature targets at the same time. And I suspect that that's going to be too big an ask of the negotiating processes.
The Pacific Conference of Churches General Secretary, Reverend James Bhagwan, says it's a reminder that more needs to be done to fight climate change.
It's great that we're consistently finding new data. I think that's an important thing, because there is no room for complacency when we look at the reports from the IPCC and new reports that come in. But I think for Pacific people, you know, it's long been said that even before we reach 1.5 degrees, we are going to be severely affected by the impacts of climate change.
And Joseph Sikulu, the Pacific director of the environmental organization 350.org, echoes that sentiment.
What we know in the Pacific, and we've known this to be true because of what we see around us, is that the temperatures are rising. We know that the science tells us this. It's outlined and forecast in the IPCC. What we are seeing now is that this is just an example of how the natural world is also telling us the same thing. And all of these are signals that we should be heeding, and we should be heeding them together to show that we are passing the red line that our survival as people in the Pacific really depends on, and that's the 1.5 degree line.
Joseph Sikulu, Pacific Director for 350.org, ending that report by Dubravka Volodya. The legal problems for Fiji's former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama continue, with the former coup leader now facing new criminal charges. He's been accused of a historical case of abuse of office dating back to 2011. Mr. Bainimarama, his former Attorney General Ayaz Said Kayum, and the country's former Health Minister, Dr. Neil Sharma, have also been charged. The ABC's Fiji reporter, Lithi Mavono, says it's the second criminal case involving the former Prime Minister, who lost office in the national election in 2022.
The three gentlemen appeared in court today to face 7 counts of corruption charges between them in front of Chief Magistrate Wallin George. It was really quite a run-of-the-mill bail hearing. All three of them were released on bail today. There was an attempt by state prosecutors to enforce strict bail conditions on the three gentlemen, but the court was not having any of it, saying that they haven't had any problems in the past, because, as you know, the former Attorney General Ayaz Said Kayum did leave the country in the middle of other unrelated charges that he is facing, and he left the country and came right back. And so they're out on bail, and the bail conditions, the only unusual thing about the bail conditions is that state prosecutors asked for cash bail bonds for the three gentlemen, given that the tenders in question in this alleged offence is worth about $1 million Fijian dollars. So they're out on bail, and they're expected back in court on the 19th of March.
Yeah, so what was the atmosphere like? Was it sort of, here we go again?
That's right. It did feel like that. It was quite a pleasant atmosphere for, you know, given the magnitude and the seriousness of what was happening. It's the same people, the usual people. And given that the Fiji police force and other authorities had indicated last year that there were other lines of investigations into both the gentlemen, there wasn't too much of a shock. There were still a lot of people, however, there to support the gentlemen. And when they came out, there was quite a feeling that this was not something serious or urgent.
Yeah. So then how is this case likely to play out regarding the charges that they are facing?
Well, the three gentlemen will appear again on the 19th, and that is most likely a plea hearing or just to hear the evidence that is available against them. But they do also have to choose the court in which they would like their case tried. Just like last time, they're likely to choose a magistrate's court, given that the penalties that can be given by the magistrates are less severe than in a high court, for example. But the abuse of office charge is quite a serious one, and it does carry a high penalty. Obstruction of justice, which the former Attorney General Ayaz Said Kayum will answer to, that is also quite serious. But a lot remains to be seen. However, on the part of the public prosecutors, who I did have a word with today, they are prepared to try this case.
Yeah. What impact do you think, Lithe, is this going to have on the political climate in Fiji?
Well, right now, it's something that's not a surprise to people, but Frank Bainimarama and ISI Kayum were very popular when they were in power. In the last elections, they did, between the two of them, pull more than 50% of the votes cast. So they're quite important people. And a lot of those people are of the view that this is nothing more than a political witch hunt. And it was definitely something that the former attorney general said when he came out of court today, Beverly.
The government needs restructuring. The economy is not doing well. Massive amounts of Fijians are leaving. The general dissatisfaction with the cost of living right now. General dissatisfaction, obviously, in terms of how the country is being governed vis-a-vis the very, what you call, weak coalition government. All those sorts of dramas that are taking place within the government.
And so now it's another year of watching abuse of office charges against the former prime minister and two other of his former ministers now, Bev.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on it as always. Good to have you on. Thanks, Lethe.
The ABC's Fiji reporter, Lethe Mavono, speaking there to the ABC's Beverly O'Connor. The government of Indonesia has agreed to fund a new morgue in Port Moresby as the existing facility in the Papua New Guinea capital struggles with a backlog of hundreds of bodies. Port Moresby General Hospital has been forced to conduct mass burials in recent weeks, with its chief executive, Paki Molumi, blaming locals for dumping bodies on its doorstep. Mr. Molumi says the morgue was not designed to house the remains of people who died outside the hospital.
Yeah, so what we do is that we give certain period of time, maybe up to 14 days of storage in our mortuary, and we put in a newspaper bed calling out for relatives to come and claim the bodies. So if no one comes and claim, then we go to the court to get a warrant of burial, and then we do the mass burials. So we do an attempt first to check out relatives or to come and claim those bodies.
Right, and how many unclaimed bodies are there at the morgue now?
We have about in a month or in 3 months we could have about 50 unclaimed bodies.
There's a report saying 257 unclaimed bodies are at the morgue. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we haven't done the... Now it's clean, like it's unclean, but we'll certainly put up the advertisement on the newspapers. And then surely those numbers will come down.
And there's plans for another mass burial in the coming weeks. Are you hoping that people will come forward and claim these bodies so that that doesn't have to take place?
We want to avoid as much as possible, you know, for people to come and claim the bodies. So that's why we give enough time for bodies. First, we do, we look at the contacts on our registry and call out for relatives to come and claim. And then the next is to go out in the newspaper. So that process is basically trying to make sure that the bodies are claimed by the relatives for a decent burial. Yeah.
Is this also an infrastructure issue? Is the mortuary fit for purpose in your mind?
Yes, in terms of the mortuary, I mean, it's the mortuary is almost over 40 years old. It was built at that time to cater for hospital deaths, only for hospital deaths. So it was expected that the city authority, National Capital District, will have its own public mortuary. But that never happened. So 40 plus years on now, we have to take on the load of the deaths outside of the hospital and then within the hospital as well. But obviously, you know, with the population increase, the number of deaths have increased over the years. So there is a, we need to improve that infrastructure. So we've been currently, that infrastructure is, we have a proposal with the Indonesian government that has been through the Indonesian grant of $15 million. So we will be building up that mortuary to accommodate to over 500 plus bodies, a cremation facility. There'll be a facility for embalming, funeral services, and as well as a forensic medicine department with a pathology department, so we can train forensic pathologists with the medical university.
That was Paki Molumi, Chief Executive of Port Moresby General Hospital, and you're speaking there to Mackenzie Smith. And that's it for Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.